Okay, it's so good to see you, Christine. We have taken a long break from doing Vaccine Curious podcast, but now we're back, and today Christine Stableben and I, Tracy Beth Hurt, we're going to be talking about Christine's experience at the World Vaccine Congress. Is that right? You just finished.
I just finished a few hours ago, so it's still very present in my memory, and I just thought it would be nice to share with you and actually also with others what I've learned through these last 3 days, 4 days actually, of Congress in terms of what is going on in the vaccine field at the moment.
Well, I'm really excited to hear what you learned and what your impressions were, because I saw one of your tweets about how surprised sort of how vaccine happy people in the United States were in terms of recommending vaccines for healthy adults. Between the ages of 18 and 65, which, or was it 11 or 12 and 65, which Denmark doesn't do.
Yeah,
that correct?
Yes. Yeah. So I was reminded of a conference in 2012 where everybody was talking about maternal immunization, and it was all new to me. I've worked in child vaccinations for many years, but it was new to me that everybody talked now about vaccinating pregnant women, and they were talking about how the swine flu pandemic and influenza vaccination had kind of paved the road for more vaccines in pregnancy, because women who used to be very scared of becoming vaccinated in pregnancy were now more accepting to become vaccinated in pregnancy. And I was completely stunned by the way people talk about it at that conference, as if there were no potential harms, and it was all a matter of how could we develop more vaccines for pregnant women, and how could we persuade and continue to keep that door open in women so that they continue to accept being vaccinated in pregnancy. Well, my main concern was really, what about the safety? Are we sure that this is actually going to be of overall health benefit for the mother and for her baby? This is, you know, a very sensitive period where it's two individuals or more, potentially, that are targeted, if she's expecting twins or more, that are affected by the same vaccine. So we need to be really sure of what we are doing. And now, well, 12 years since that, many new vaccines are in the pipeline for pregnant women, and I have to accept it, or well, I've witnessed that this is becoming the new normal to vaccinate women in pregnancy. But what I was really stunned about at the conference was the way that people now talk about adult vaccination, and how that is that was emphasized by Mandy Cohen, who is the director of CDC, who said this was really an area of extreme importance, and where a lot of resources would be allocated in the coming years. And there was a whole session at the Congress that was dedicated to discussing adult vaccination. And I have to say, I was sitting with the same feeling as in 2012, and just thinking, what about the safety? Because again, here it was the same way it was discussed. It was not about safety at all, but it was about how do we get vaccination coverage rates up, and particularly because people, adults, don't walk around and feel vulnerable, so how do we make them understand that they need to get vaccinated? And I had to go up and ask the question, or rather maybe give the comment that in Denmark we haven't found it necessary to vaccinate any healthy non-pregnant person between the HPV vaccine at 12 years and then the influenza vaccine at 65 years, and we actually do pretty well, so health-wise. So it's coming back to what you and I have discussed in these podcasts, the huge differences in vaccination programs between Denmark and the U.S. emphasize that the science isn't settled. It's clear Danish health authorities aren't stupid, I should think. So if the data was so clear-cut that it was beneficial to be vaccinated as an adult, it would also be implemented in Denmark. But the exact fact that there are differences in programs mean that different public health authorities can look at the data and reach different conclusions. And I think it's still, given that fact, that it isn't urgently necessary for adult health, I think there's all the more reason to be very concerned about safety. And that was my main surprised, I think, at the Congress that there was so much talk about adult vaccination and so little talk about vaccine safety.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to say about that, because there's obviously a number of reasons that there could be that difference between Scandinavia and the U.S., right? And so we should point out that you're in the U.S. right now. The conference was in the United States and not in Denmark. And so the United States, we recommend yearly COVID vaccine, yearly influenza vaccine. We now recommend the RSV vaccine to adults 60 and older. We recommend the RSV vaccine during pregnancy as well. And so in Denmark,
and
there's not that.
Soster.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you for mentioning that too. And in Denmark, you know, the public health authorities, to my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, don't seem to have that same conflict of interest that we have in the United States with the revolving door with the FDA, with people going to then work for, you know, drug companies after they regulate the drugs, and the CDC, we've clearly seen, has, you know, they have also conflicts of interest, and it seems, you know, they seem more like a marketing arm of the pharmaceutical industries. Unfortunately, we've been seeing that more and more in the United States. And so culturally, the United States, we look more, we don't have that same influence, and we don't have that same perspective of looking at vaccines as Denmark does, where it seems like here we more look at just, you know, vaccines can only be a good, and are very reluctant to, you know, discuss the harms. And I want to get back to why the reasons that may be, but one of them is certainly things that we've discussed before with researchers in the United States losing their funding or losing their jobs, even if they publish about vaccine safety, or, for example, question the appropriateness of giving vaccines to, for example, people that have already had the disease, like happened to Aaron Cariotti and Martin Kulldorff. And I described recently my experience at UC Davis with my publication on post-vaccination myocarditis. And so we don't really have a research culture or academic culture that supports looking at vaccine safety to the same extent that Denmark does, or other countries. I'm curious to hear your takes on that.
No, but I it absolutely resonates with what I experienced at the Congress, because I went up and said, you know, we different countries have different policies, as I explained, and Denmark, we don't vaccinate. I failed to see the necessity for vaccinating, and afterwards, I heard people had asked somebody I know if I was an anti-vax, which is absurd. I don't know when that when that connection between being interested and occupied with vaccine safety is equal to being anti-vax. I was reminded, being now in the U.S., of the McCarthy period and the way you stigmatized and ostracized people, and you could shame them with using the word communist and or communist tendencies, etc. There's a little bit the same narrative around people who work on vaccine safety or who are concerned about vaccine safety, and it's incredible to me. For any other pharmaceutical products, and for any patients, it should be important that there is concern about safety. But in exactly the area of vaccines, it has become very troublesome, and it was also reflected at the Congress in the fact that there was a session on vaccine safety, but it was in the smallest of the rooms. So, you know, it was a tenth of the size of the rooms that looked into veterinary vaccines or influenza and pandemic responses, etc. So we were a small group of people who were in that room, and to be honest, it was like, you know, you had to start any sentence or any question or remark or presentation by stating that we all agree that vaccines are extremely important. But you know, it's like, yeah, it was maybe McCarthy, or it was the Inquisition. You know, you have to swear on the Bible that you are for vaccines.
Part of the club. Yeah.
Yeah. but to be saying serious. So it's, I mean, it's somewhat absurd, I have to say. But that being said, I really, really enjoyed the vaccine safety session, where I gave a presentation on non-specific effects of vaccines, and other people were talking about adverse events, particularly after COVID-19 vaccines, but also after other vaccines. And they were, I was enthusiastic about a great presentation by Daniel Solomon, who's the director of vaccine safety at Johns Hopkins University, and together with Bob Shen, who's the director of the Brighton Collaboration, and other strong voices are now have now written a proposal to establish sustained funding for vaccine safety research. So there are brave people out there who can see the necessity. So I hope in future congresses that, as I think it should be, the room with the vaccine safety session will be one of the biggest ones. It ought to be. It ought to be on
right
of major concern, and particularly given that we are now, or some countries are now moving into vaccinating otherwise completely healthy people with an incredible small risk of severe disease from the vaccine disease. So the benefit, in other words, is going to be really small for some of these adult pregnancy and adult vaccinations, and that makes the safety concern all the bigger.
Right. Well, I'm glad to hear that it sounds like in the United States, like an academic institution like Johns Hopkins is supportive of doing research like that, because I know that's been an issue, that if, you know, they may be hesitant to take private funding for studies that are looking at vaccine safety, just sort of out of fear that things might be found that will be, you know, inconvenient fundings, that are findings that will conflict with, you know, large research grants that the academic institutions may have received from the pharmaceutical industry. So I do hope that we see more of that, more of willingness to look into the, you know, the risks versus the benefits, because obviously, you know, the burden of proof is on showing that, you know, the benefits outweigh the risks. And I mean, we could mention so many vaccines, but Denmark has now, you know, as we've discussed many times, has said that, you know, it was a mistake to vaccinate children for COVID-19, looking at the benefits and the risks. And here we are still in the United States, still recommending that vaccine on a yearly basis. But I'm glad to hear that Johns Hopkins looks like they're starting a program, that's good. And let's just hope that they are able also to publish, you know, publish their results in an honest and transparent way. And, you know, we've talked about before the importance of including all the raw data when people publish their findings, so other researchers can verify and can replicate their findings. You and I have been working on establishing a vaccine research program with a few researchers here in the United States and in Denmark, and so hopefully we'll be able to get that off the ground soon, and we can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, but it should get off the ground. And the issue here, which we all agree on, is that the people who think that we can circumvent looking at vaccine safety simply haven't understood that this is the greatest disservice that you can do to vaccine safety and to vaccine confidence. Because, of course, people would want to see that this is something that that authorities and providers take super seriously. Just as you wouldn't fly, I'm now about to go out into Iceland air and fly away, if they had announced in advance that our flights are always safe. Don't worry.
Right. They don't publish any of the historical data on what's happened in their flights. They don't allow you to ask questions and
you want to be pretty sure that safety is on the top of their list, and they should be very explicit about it. And likewise, I think this is what the vaccine providers should be so clear about. Anyway, not to make this a very long podcast and to get to the full summary, I'll just look down at my notes here, Tracy, to give you the full picture of the Congress, or at least my highlights, which are, of course, very subjective. Last comment on this part about vaccine safety. There were a few young researchers who approached me after I had presented my data, and who told me that they were so glad that other people were looking into vaccine safety, so on. But they were also telling me about intellectual isolation in their own institutions and the need for networks. And that's also coming back to this issue about how difficult it has become to talk about and to study and to publish in the area of vaccine safety. It's super worrying that there are young researchers out there who feel so isolated in their own institutions. And I just praise them for their bravery to venture into the field and promise them all the support I could give them in their careers, because we need young researchers. But you can see how that there's no fertile grounds for entering into that area as a young researcher. You know, you're entering a field where you get so bashed up at.
Oh, absolutely. There's no incentive.
No. So this is something I'm also concerned about, and was further concerned about after this Congress. That to get to be sure to be able to recruit new talent in this area is going to be a challenge given the current climate.
Yes, we'll need to start a network of people so we can encourage each other's work and help each other. Well, and just doing this podcast, I think helps. But yeah, no, I go on. I did. This is a good summary.
So, given my own presentation, I'm somewhat depressed, I have to say, that so many people still aren't aware of non-specific effects of vaccines, because it is, and I'm saying that very confidently now everywhere, because this is how it is. It's proven beyond doubt that vaccines can affect the risk of other infections. We know that for sure. And nobody contradicts that. When I've said it, and I've said it loud and in many places at the Congress, nobody contradicts it. Everybody nods. This is a given. You cannot see a vaccine as something that only induces specific immunity to that target disease and doesn't affect the immune system in broader ways. But still, the room becomes quiet when I then say, what then? Because this has implications for vaccine programs and how we design them to optimize both the specific and the non-specific effects. And this has implications for how we test and approve and regulate vaccines. Because right now there is a big gap, and everybody also agrees on that, because we don't test the effect of vaccines on other infections in the phase 3 trials or in the post-marketing surveillance. So we know that they have effect on the immune system and the risk of other infections. We know from the high titer measles vaccine, for instance, that these effects can be negative, and still it's not investigated. So I'm, in that sense, left a little... Yeah, not a little. I'm very depressed by the fact that the findings are out there, but nobody wants to touch that hot potato and deal with it. And I simply lack measures, I think, to create more awareness than I'm doing already now. And coming back to the recruitment problem, I have a group of super great, fantastic researchers, but they are the brave ones who have ventured into this. It's hard to recruit. It's a challenge to recruit people into this field, again, because it's controversial, it's perceived as controversial, perceived as potentially, you know, it can be so quickly tagged as being anti-vax, though it's so far from the truth, but that scares people away from that field, I think, and scares also clearly more experienced researchers, perhaps, for entering the field. So we are there with science that clearly points out that there are omissions in the way that we look at vaccines, but still it hasn't had the implications that I thought it ought to have.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just makes me think of the, so we're going to be doing a podcast with Ram Durasetti, and you have looked at the COVID vaccines and found in children that there was that signal for increased risk of other infections that were not COVID-19. And so we're going to be discussing that more, but it is very concerning that researchers' primary objective isn't to discover and to find the truth and to learn more about these, you know, vaccines and, you know, whatever treatments we have. And I was thinking about, you did a podcast with Peter Gutsche, where you actually discussed these non-specific effects. And it was a fascinating podcast. And you covered a lot of the data and the studies, including the BCG vaccine and the DTP vaccine. So the BCG vaccine seeming to have beneficial non-specific effects, and DTP, really you find the opposite in girls. And he talked about how he did the Cochrane review, or attempted to do that, of the DTP vaccine, and then how the World Health Organization really wouldn't accept his findings. And then your video, it was censored off of LinkedIn, and talk about, you know, discouraging discussion about these important topics and seeking the truth. And I recommend that people listen to that podcast, because I want to say he's a very respected lecturer, at least was at the University of Copenhagen in the medical school. And my husband talks about what a good teacher he was. And I just think about how now it's like, you look him up on Wikipedia and it says he's become known for spreading, quote, misinformation. And I'm listening to the podcast and I'm thinking, this sounds like an amazing scientist who is the head of the Nordic Cochrane Review and a respected medical lecturer. And I mean, and then you talk about the term anti-vaxxer. And I just think about how unhelpful all these terms are. And the only thing that we can keep doing, I think, is to continue to talk about our research and the questions that we have, and how to do, you know, research into these topics to generate interest, so that people aren't being discouraged because they might be censored or labeled or so.
Yeah,
those are my thoughts on that.
Moving to more positive aspects, there was a lot of talk about gender differences and how we cannot just assume that men and women will respond equally to vaccines, or in fact we have to assume, or we know, that they will respond differently, with women responding with more antibodies to almost all vaccines that we know of, and also responding with more adverse events, which historically have been dismissed as, you know, female being more sensitive or more likely to report.
Complain? No.
Exactly, yeah. So maybe it is a little psychological. We just saw it with the menstrual irregularities after COVID-19 vaccine, that perhaps it isn't completely over, but I think we are moving towards an era where it will be over, because it's so clear that there are biological differences in the vaccine response, so it's obviously also
absolutely
reasonable to expect sex differences in the adverse events, and perhaps think about like my good colleague and friend Sarah Klein at Johns Hopkins, whether she speculated that at one stage that females should just have half the dose or even less of an influenza vaccine, because they mount the same antibody response with half the dose. So why is it that we maintain equal doses for the two sexes, genders, whatever term we use? But anyway, I think that was encouraging to hear that everybody, at least who discussed it at the panel where that came up, were in agreement that this is an important variable to take into account when we talk about vaccines and also vaccine safety.
Certainly the post-vaccination myocarditis has brought that into the public eye.
That's true. That's another very important difference that was noted.
And the central venous thrombosis, obviously, with the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, happened more often in women, too. Yeah. So, I mean, it's clear, it's very clear with side effects that we see the sex differences.
So today's session was today there was a session on malaria vaccine, and I think that I just want to end by mentioning that one, because it was so interesting that there are now two malaria vaccines pre-qualified for use in Africa, and that is the RTSS malaria vaccine and the R21 malaria vaccine. And there was a big discussion on the panel about which vaccine was the best, or at least there were some who felt that their vaccine was better than others. It was quite interesting. Anyway, what I went up to propose was that we had a proper randomized trial with the two vaccines and a placebo arm, so three arms where the two vaccines could be tested against each other, but also against placebo, because my worry, again, And it's not like I want to worry, but since nobody else worries, there's a little niche left that when I see data that's worrying and nobody else raises their concern, that's yet another area where I have to voice my concern, because for both RTSS and R21. In the phase 3 trials, there was increased mortality in the recipients of the vaccine. And in none of the trials, it reached statistical significance. But when we got the RTSS data from GSK and analyzed it, we could show that the increase in mortality was very differential, with a twofold higher mortality for females who received the RTSS. And that was seen in the two different age groups that received RTSS, and it was independently significant in each age group. So, you know, the probability that this was a chance event is less than 1 out of 1,000. It's a very striking difference, where and the vaccine protected somewhat against malaria. So in males, you saw the anticipated 15% non-significant reduction in all-cause mortality. But this very highly significantly different effect in females with their twofold higher mortality was really a danger signal. Now GSK claims that this danger signal has been refuted, because they did a pilot implementation study where they, in some areas, gave the vaccine and a lot of health services, and in other areas, they gave nothing. They didn't know the number of children in each of the areas. They only had a guesstimate of the people living there. They didn't do any individual registration of those who got the vaccine or not, but they relied on village informants to tell how many children had died. And they used that data to say that they found a 13%, they haven't published any data to document that, they just published the number, a 13% reduction in all-cause mortality in the RTSS intervention areas. And we have pointed out on several occasions, this pilot implementation cannot address the safety of the RTSS vaccine when you give it together with other health interventions. And by the way, you yes. have many individual numbers, you rely on village reporters. Thus, I should say that they post hoc, after opening the data and starting to analyze, they introduced in their statistical analysis plan a control for the mortality in the younger age groups that was not pre-planned. And if you don't control for the younger age groups, you have higher mortality in the intervention areas. So to me, all this is plus another thing. Mortality was a safety signal, so it should be analyzed already after the first dose, but they redefined it as an efficacy outcome, which is then only analyzed after the third dose, so they cut away a lot of the follow-up time. So there are so many things in that analysis. So if I had done that study and claimed to have found a reduction in mortality, I would have been crucified for malpractice. But right. Just a long story to say, the RTSS danger signal has not been refuted in my mind, or in my opinion. The R21 was recently published. There was 2.5-fold higher mortality, non-significantly so, in the vaccine recipient. But there shouldn't be, for a malaria vaccine that reduces the risk of malaria by 78%, you should have a reduction in all-cause mortality, not an increase. And despite our request and despite the results well known of the RTSS and the increased female mortality, the authors of the R21 phase 3 trials have not given the data broken down by vaccine group and sex. So you cannot see if this is due to an increased female mortality. So we have asked for the data. We hope to get them to provide more clear answers to whether there's also an increased female mortality associated with R21. But basically, this is a long story to say, I went up and I said there are these lingering mortality questions in relation to both vaccines. So I would like to do this three-arm study, comparing them back-to-back, given all this discussion, which is best, and with a placebo group, so we could see whether who did best in terms of overall mortality, those who got either or of the two vaccines or those who got placebo. And hopefully it should be very clear that those who got the two malaria vaccines had lower mortality than those who got placebo. Otherwise, we shouldn't introduce the vaccines. They should use
absolutely, right? Obviously this highlights what we were talking about, that we need data transparency and sharing, because it sounds like you could get the answer just from looking at the data if this was a significant signal in females. But it sounds like GlaxoSmithKline, right, that owns the data. They're not giving the data away.
R21 is actually Oxford University, but no, they haven't so far. They haven't shared the data. I would say there are too few deaths, I think, for in any case to make it significant. But it's important to look for that signal, given that another vaccine has had that signal.
It's underpowered. So that's also a question: was why is this study so small when this is all-cause mortality? That's an important endpoint.
This is why I proposed this study, and my question was to the producers of these two vaccines. I said, if I would like to do such a trial, the two vaccine groups and the placebo group, if I can find the sites that are willing to undertake this study, will you provide the vaccines? And guess what? No, there was no commitment to do that. and I'm really
surprise.
Yeah, because nobody, and there I heard a lot of mumbling and saw a lot of nodding in the audience when I said that from a scientific perspective, from a safety perspective, there can be no doubt that this is the way forward, that we should do such a study to get full information on the effect of these vaccines on all-cause mortality. So we didn't know that it's worthwhile. This is going to, the GSK vaccine costs $10 per dose, and their children should receive at least 4 doses. I think this is a major, major investment for an African country, and these money could be, they should be used where they make a difference. So
yes, absolutely.
And definitely they shouldn't be used on a vaccine that increases female mortality if we believe the results from the phase 3 trials, which again, to me, it's puzzling that everybody that are in favor of this RTSS vaccine seem to emphasize that a pilot implementation study, which is almost like an ecological study, over a phase 3 individually randomized placebo-controlled trial. Can you follow me? It's such a turnaround of the evidence pyramid that that everybody says with a complete, innocent face that, yes, this pilot implementation has now refuted what was shown in the randomized trial.
Gosh, I mean, it doesn't it really just suggest that this is so much more about selling a product than it is about actual health and getting the data that we need? Because if it were, as you say, we would like to know if this is an overall harmful and not beneficial product as soon as possible. So if it's not, the funds can be redirected towards finding something that works better, right? But it's, if it were about getting the true answer, they would be very forthcoming with the data and be wanting to know if this is overall beneficial for people's health. And, being willing to individualize it. So does it work for, women versus, boys versus men? Like maybe there's a subpopulation that it doesn't work for. Like these are basic epidemiological, basic scientific questions that it seems like, they just don't want to have to ask if they can make money, right? I mean, that's the problem with having a pharmaceutical company run the trial, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. I think everybody would feel more reassured if it was an independent assessment of such a product after it was licensed. That's clear that, it would be good to separate the economical interests from the scientific questions. Anyway, this was a brief summary of my experience at the World Vaccine Congress. Overall, I really enjoyed being there, I have to say. There were so many nice people. I've met old friends and new friends, and was happy to see that Bali Pulendran, who's also a really great colleague from close to you at Stanford, he won a prize for the best academic whatever. Yeah, there were a lot of prizes for the industry, but the academic prize for academia, he won. So, it was overall super, super good, super interesting, and nice to know a little bit more and be a bit more informed about what is on people's mind in the world of vaccinology, including on the industry's mind.
Yeah, well, thanks for such an excellent summary, and I was happy to see you in person in Florida, by the way. And I hope you enjoyed your trip to the United States. So, and I have a great trip back to Denmark, and we'll be talking again this weekend.
Will we?
Is that right? Okay. Yeah, I think. Well, we'll be having a podcast soon with Ram Dorisetti, where we'll be going over one of your recent studies. So. On non-specific effects of the COVID vaccine and evidence for that.
Actually, it's going to be your Sunday night and my Monday morning. I think that's why I didn't think about it as the weekend. Yeah, next week. Okay, thank you very much, Tracy.
Thank you, Christine. All right.